Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. We're having a lot of fun answering the questions of the planet Earth today. Questions that are coming to us via the internet from all over. It's an internet open forum. And Jimmy Akin is our guest. Thanks for being back, Jimmy.
My pleasure. You know, we don't discriminate against, like, the International Space Station.
That's true. That's true.
We should have, and they have email up there. We should maybe see if we could do a interstellar open forum or interplanetary open forum where we let specifically let people who are not on Earth ask their questions about the Catholic faith. Maybe we could have the astronauts up on the International Space Station give us their questions.
Are you taking notes on this, Darren? Don't let this gold go to waste. All right, this is programming gold. The number of people off the Earth, it just seems like it's going to get bigger and bigger without much delay.
Within a few years, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like we're finally.
Of course, it won't be possible to do live radio with, like, folks on Mars.
No. The delay changes
depending on how close, depending on where Earth and Mars are in their orbits. But it could be, like, you know, a 20-minute delay or something.
You know, when Mars goes, there's a time every couple of years where Mars is exactly opposite the sun. I mean, like, you'd have to go through the sun to get to Mars, in other words, right?
Well, without commenting on the timing, yes.
So I wonder if you can communicate with Mars at those times.
The best bet would be using a relay.
Had to be something over there on the other side.
Like you could have a satellite out to one side of the sun and bounce your radio signals off of that to aim them at Mars.
Because I'm not going until we have complete coverage.
Mm-hmm. You like your Wi-Fi.
I do, right. Yeah. I don't want to have periods where you're behind the sun. You can't get the Celtic scores. All right, well, let's get back to the internet's questions. I'm sorry we have limited to Earth this time, but in the future we will work on that. Carolyn asks, how can I explain the historicity of the Old Testament and where it came from to a seven-year-old, a very smart seven-year-old?
Okay. So in terms of the historicity of the Old Testament, it's gonna depend on what he's asking about. The way the Old Testament is written changes. The very earliest chapters of Genesis, particularly the first 11 chapters, are very clearly not written according to later historical conventions. Yeah. And so what Pius XII said was that they do pertain to history, and so they contain historical truths, but they also contain metaphors and symbols. And so they shouldn't be read as if all of this is straightforward history. It's history written in a kind of stylized way. In terms of how to communicate that to a seven-year-old, I'd have to know the seven-year-old and what, you know, exactly how smart he is and what he's aware of. But I would say that if he's asking about these early chapters of Genesis, I would say they do contain information about the world and how it began, but they aren't the same kind of writing that we have later in the Bible, which uses, because I don't want to say incorporates to a seven-year-old unless I have to, which includes or uses more detail, more information about history. In terms of later, after those chapters, well, we have a lot of archaeological evidence, things that scientists have dug up that supports, information later in the Old Testament. We have, for example, it talks about David being a king of Israel, and we found artifacts, you know, things that scholars have dug up that say things on them like, this belonged to the house of David.
Yeah.
We have mentions of prophets like, I want to say Naaman, that's the leper. It's Talking Donkey Guy.
I'm sorry, Jimmy. But as soon as you asked me a question, all knowledge goes out of my head.
While you look it up, we have references to him too. There are inscriptions that refer to, and it's not Buridan, that's the philosopher.
Balaam.
Balaam, yeah. Okay, so Balaam the prophet, we've got references outside the Bible to him as well.
I didn't know that, actually. That's really cool.
Yeah, there's an inscription that talks about him.
Oh,
and it's not
cool.
It's not a Jewish inscription. So, you know, Balaam is not a Jew.
Uh-huh.
He's a Canaanite. And so we have Canaanite records of him. We also have records of other kings and of events that happened, like the Babylonian exile. And so we actually have a lot of this information. Now, most of it is in books that are not written for seven-year-olds, but it could be helpful for a seven-year-old just to know that we do have information that scientists have dug up that supports these, you know, these various things in the Old Testament.
Right.
In terms of an overall book that is meant and that deals with how we got the Old Testament. I mean, basically it was written over a period of about 1,000 years before the time of Christ. And it was written by different authors, but God was using them to give us his word. And so it was all part of God's plan. If he'd like to read something that has a, probably most of it would be within his range, would be, if he's a smart seven-year-old, would be my book, The Bible is a Catholic Book, because I deliberately wrote that one in a way to make it easy to read for people. And so a smart seven-year-old might be able to handle that one.
Carolyn, thank you very, very much for that question. The Egyptologists are uncovering more and more that seems to be helpful.
There is some. And there are various things in Genesis and Exodus and so forth that are confirmed by Egyptology, including a lot of the names. The names of various people that we read about in the early books of the Bible when they were in contact with Egypt are actually Egyptian names.
Yeah.
Like Hor. Uh-huh. That's the god Horus.
Right.
And there were Egyptians named Hor, and there were Jews who came out of Egypt named Hor.
Uh-huh.
Moses is also an Egyptian name.
Right.
It means born or drawn out.
Uh-huh. And there's a thing in I think it's the book of Exodus, where they built the storage cities. Do you know?
Yeah, they built two store cities.
What does that mean? I don't
even... They're cities that have supplies.
Oh, okay.
Where you store things,
yeah.
Like food or military equipment or things like that.
Yeah.
And they built two cities that are known as Pithom and Ramesses.
Yeah.
Pithom means house of the god Atum.
Uh-huh.
And it's identified with the archaeological site known as Avaris. And Ramses is known as Pi-Ramses today, the House of Ramses.
Uh-huh.
But this may be a little more than her seven-year-old wants to know.
No, but it's just, to me, even if you don't get into all the detail, the awareness that the connection between the history and that's available outside the Bible and then mm-hmm. what's in the Bible, it helps to
coincide.
Yeah. To kind of build up confidence, I think, in what you're reading. This one comes from Ron, and also kind of an ancient world question. Ron asks, how is Ur called Ur of the Chaldeans in Genesis when that culture didn't appear until centuries later?
So Ron's referring to the fact that Abraham leaves Ur of the Chaldees maybe around 1800 BC.
Yeah.
But the Chaldeans don't really rise for a few centuries after that. Now, the basic explanation of why it's got of the Chaldees there at all is because there were multiple cities named Ur mm-hmm. in the ancient world, just like there are multiple cities with the same name today. You have Hollywood, California, and Hollywood, Florida.
Right.
You have Paris, France, and you have Paris, Texas. And so that's why we add... Now, sometimes if it's the famous one, we'll just say Hollywood.
Yeah,
and
right.
And people
right.
will think, oh, California. But sometimes we'll make it explicit, Hollywood, the one in California.
Yeah.
Or we'll Hollywood, the one in Florida.
Yeah.
And people in the ancient world did that too. They would need to distinguish some cities from another. So you'll have like Antioch in Pisidia versus Antioch in Syria.
Yeah.
and you'll have such and such on the Orontes, meaning the one on the Orontes River.
Right.
Well, we need to do that to identify which one of them we're talking about, and they needed to do that in the ancient world too. So here we have Ur, and it's translated in English as of the Chaldeans. In Hebrew, what it says is Kasdim. And there's a question about who the Kasdim were. It could be the Chaldeans. They were referred to by that name later on. But it's also been proposed it might have been a different group known as the Kassites. And the Kassites were around in Abraham's time. Mm-hmm. So Ur of the Chaldees may be a mistranslation of Ur of the Kassites.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, this is being written like, 800 years later. And so it's written after the time that the Chaldeans arose in this area.
Right.
And so what a lot of people would say is this is just a contemporary clarifier. It clarifies which one we're talking about, but using the terms we're familiar with today.
Yeah.
In other words, it's the Ur that's currently in the territory of the Chaldeans.
Right.
Even though the Chaldeans weren't there before.
Right.
And this would be like if I'm talking about, Paul went to the city of Ephesus in Turkey.
Yeah, but there was no Turkey.
There was no Turkey in Paul's day. It was the Roman province of Asia Minor.
Right.
Turkey is a modern state, but I let people know which modern state it's in, even though that state didn't exist in Paul's day. If I say Paul went to Ephesus in Turkey, it would be like saying Abraham came out of Ur in Chaldea, meaning today's Chaldea, even though we're talking about the past.
Thanks, Ron. Thanks for that question. Got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this.
Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin is coming right back.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
The power of prayer simply means that words have an effect. For example, when a couple says, "I do," it literally changes two people to becoming one in marriage. When you say, "I love you," it changes us and it gives us value. The power of prayer is in the words and in the sentiment, but it's also in the fact that God, who is omnipotent, all-powerful, answers our prayers.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin's our guest, and we're answering questions from the internet. It's an internet open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. And the next one comes from Gareth, who asks this, Jimmy. Is it true that Nagasaki was a Catholic city in Japan? If so, why was it destroyed in 1945? And to go back to 1941, what do you make of the conspiracy theory that the American government knew of the attack on Pearl Harbor before it happened, but let it go ahead to get America into World War II? Love your show, by the way. Hello from Wales. I do not believe that. Wales cannot type. This has got to be from a human.
No, not Wales. Wales. The location in Great Britain.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. All right. So I do believe this then. Yeah.
So great to hear from you, Gareth. Hello back to Wales from California. In regard to Nagasaki, yes, it's a historically Catholic city in Japan. My understanding is its formation was heavily influenced by trade with the Portuguese and, the missionaries they had sent. So there was a large Japanese Catholic population there. Unfortunately, when Japan closed in on itself in, I guess, the 1600s, Christians, including especially Catholics, who were there, were greatly persecuted. And so Christianity had to go largely underground for a number of centuries and didn't come back out into the open until the Meiji Restoration in the mid-1800s. So as a result, even though it may have been heavily Catholic influenced early on, that didn't mean that it was an openly Catholic city with people out in the open being Catholics ever since.
Right.
You know, there were a lot of non-Catholics there, and it was not an openly Catholic city until you had more people being able to come back out into public as Catholics with the Meiji Restoration. And so there were Catholics there. I don't believe in 1941 that they were the majority of the population, but they were there. And in some of the books I've read about the atomic bombings, there were people in church at Nagasaki when the bomb fell. In terms of why it was targeted, well, I've seen the targeting criteria of, you know, that they were saying, okay, what kinds of targets? We've only got these two bombs right now.
Yeah.
You know, little boy and fat man. What are we going to use them on? You know, we don't want to just drop them anywhere. And so they did have targeting criteria that were developed. And they wanted, like, large population centers to cause maximum psychological impact. So this was terrorism. They were deliberately targeting large population centers, as well as centers that had war works in them, you know, some kind of military assets, military manufacturing plants. And Nagasaki did that. Nagasaki was a port, and it had, or actually, let me take that back. Nagasaki did have munitions plants and stuff there.
Mm-hmm.
So it also had military value, but religion is not listed in the targeting criteria. I mean, I've seen the targeting criteria. It does not list anything about religion. So they were looking to bomb cities that had certain characteristics, but religion was not one of them. Now, I have heard people say, oh, well, secretly some anti-Catholic Protestant or something was picking Nagasaki, even though it's not written in the criteria. I can imagine. I've heard people suggest that there was some kind of anti-Catholicism motivating the bombing of Nagasaki. But it's not in the criteria.
Yeah.
And Nagasaki was not the primary target that day.
Right.
Instead, so what they would do on a run like this, and not just for this, but for other bombing missions too, they'd have a primary target they want you to get to. If you can't get to that target for some reason, then they would have backup targets so that you could at least do some damage rather than waste a trip.
Yeah.
You know, you fly out, oh, sorry, can't bomb here, let's just go back. They would have secondary targets as well as targets of opportunity so that you could try to advance the war effort that way, even if you couldn't do your primary target. Well, that's what happened on August 9th, 1945. They sent the bomber boxcar with the first plutonium bomb to be used. The one in Hiroshima was a uranium bomb.
Mm-hmm.
But this was a plutonium bomb, and they sent it out to bomb Kokura, which was another city in this part of Japan. And the problem was when they got to Kokura, it was really cloudy, and there was a lot of smoke because of another town that had been bombed nearby, and there was a lot of smoke. And they couldn't properly find the target because of all the cloud and smoke cover. So they said, okay, we can't do Kokura. What else is on the list? And Nagasaki was on the list. So they diverted to Nagasaki. They also had problems at Nagasaki. There was a lot of cloud and smoke there as well. But at the last minute, it parted enough for them to be able to say, oh, here's where we are with respect to the center of Nagasaki or whatever, and they dropped the bomb at that point. So it doesn't look to me like religion really played any role in the bombing of Nagasaki. It wasn't in the targeting selection criteria. It wasn't the primary target that day, and it was only because the clouds parted at the last minute that Nagasaki ended up getting bombed at all.
Arigato for that, Jimmy, but there was also a second point,
part of the question. So there are different versions of the theory that the United States knew about the attack on Pearl Harbor. Now, one thing to understand is there was tension between Japan and the United States at this point anyway. They were actually negotiating to try to avoid a war. And everybody knew that if there's an attack by the Japanese, Pearl Harbor is likely to be where it's going to be because it's much closer to Japan, the Hawaiian Islands are much closer to Japan than, say, the coast of California. So which are you going to attack, the close thing or the far thing?
Right.
Also, that's where we had lots of our Navy housed. And so you want to attack a military target, not just avocado groves. And so if there was an attack, it would have been Pearl Harbor. Now, and you had predictions for years beforehand that a war was coming with the Japanese and Pearl Harbor was going to be the target. What was not clear to everybody is that a war would happen and that it would begin with a sneak attack without warning on Pearl Harbor. And so the claim is from some people that that we had advanced knowledge of this because of Japanese codes that we had broken and been able to decrypt various internal Japanese communications that either said or implied that an attack was coming on Pearl Harbor. And some have claimed that, yeah, we got those decoded, but then they kind of got stalled in the bureaucracy.
Yeah.
And or some people have said, yeah, or, you know, there was a they really did get up to people who should have blown the whistle on this, but they decided not to for one reason or another. And some have even suggested that President Franklin Roosevelt heard about this but decided not to act because he wanted to get into he wanted to get the U.S. into World War II, which it was not at the time.
Right.
Now, a lot of that is has been talked over. I have not personally done a detailed investigation of it yet, so I'm open on these questions. Now, the standard view that you'll hear most of the time is that maybe we heard some comm chatter from the Japanese, but it got lost in the bureaucracy, and there was no deliberate failure to act.
Right.
And that's the common view, but I haven't done a detailed investigation yet. I will for Mysterious World, but I haven't done it yet, so I don't personally have an opinion at this point. There's another possibility, though, besides just we intercepted their comm traffic and didn't act deliberately.
Yes, what's that?
We provoked them. Because there's a guy named Harry Dexter White, who is a senior advisor in the Treasury Department, who was revealed after the war to have been a Soviet agent known as Jurist, whose identity was revealed by the Venona decrypts, where we did decrypt Soviet comm chatter.
Yeah.
And so this guy in the Treasury Department, Harry Dexter White, now it's debated how conscious he was of all of this, but according to some individuals, he played a role in sabotaging our negotiations with Japan because the Soviet Union
wanted Japan and
wanted
to fight America.
To fight America, yeah. Because they were terrified with the Germans on their eastern front or on their western front. They couldn't both fight the Germans and the Japanese on their eastern front. And so they wanted America in the war to safeguard the Soviet Union. And so the claim is that the NKDV, the predecessor of the KGV, then enlisted Harry Dexter White and possibly others to sabotage negotiations with the Japanese to guarantee that we'd get into a war with them.
Uh-huh.
But again, that's a theory I'm currently researching. I don't have a definitive conclusion, but I'm open. If you want a real conspiracy that really did happen and that we do know about connected with all this.
Oh, really?
Check out episode 113 of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. It's titled Desperate Coup in Japan, and it deals with an incident right at the end of the war where the Imperial Palace was taken over and the Emperor in captivity for purposes of forcing him to continue the war.
Right, right, yeah. Okay, you can find all that at Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and many, many more things. You said episode 113. How many episodes are there now?
We're in the 160s now.
Nice. Francisco asks this, Jimmy. He says, angels for me were always child's play. I'm reminded of the kitschy image of an angel guiding children over a bridge. But what should angels, guardian or otherwise, mean to me as an adult? I am aware that there must be a guide in my life at moments when I could have easily gone off the rails, but something kept me from doing so. But I can't still help but feel that angels aren't for me on a spiritual or psychological level, even though I wear a St. Michael the Archangel medal. Help me to understand.
Well, a lot of the images that you see of angels in art can be sentimental and a little saccharine for some people's taste. And yeah, that's not how the Bible depicts angels. The angels in the Bible are depicted either simply as human beings or, I mean, they've taken the form of human beings, or if they appear in a different form, it's weird and fearsome, which is a way of communicating the fact that angels are much more powerful than us. And they'll be like covered in eyes and stuff, which signifies that they know a lot more than we do.
Yeah.
So the various aspects of the forms they take, you know, like they've got the face of a lion or a bull, you know, that indicates their strength and their fearsomeness. The imagery itself can be a source of information, but we'll have more to say right after the break.
All right, we'll be right back with more Internet Open Forum with our guest, Jimmy Akin, right after this.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Bishop Joseph Strickland of Tyler, Texas, is one of the most courageous leaders in the church, known for his outspoken support of unborn life, Orthodox faith and morals, and reforming Catholic institutions. In his groundbreaking new book, Light and Leaven, he offers a forthright perspective on the state of the church today and calls on the lay faithful to meet its challenges boldly. Touching on topics including parish renewal, the centrality of the Eucharist, the need for prayer and silence in a noisy and distracted age, and the battle between good and evil in the church and world, Bishop Strickland's wise insights and evident love for souls will inspire and edify you. To order your copy of Light and Leaven, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
To many people, even many Christians, purgatory is a fantasy, or worse, a wicked lie invented by the church to make salvation complicated and keep people in fear. But I'm here to tell you that purgatory is fact, not fiction. The Bible supports it, Christians have historically believed in it, and it makes theological sense. In my new book, Purgatory is for Real, I provide the evidence and reasoning to help you understand this controversial doctrine and demonstrate how it's actually a joyful, hopeful reality, not something shadowy and mysterious, but a sign of God's love and mercy. To get your copy of Purgatory is for Real, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Nice. I will accept it. Anytime the groovy music plays, I'm not going to ask why. I just accept it. Thank you very much for the groovy music. It's starting to become just associated with Jimmy, I think. If Jimmy's on, we're doing open forum. Play some groovy music.
Well, this pre-record we're doing maybe on a Thursday.
It might be. Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll see. Francisco had asked about angels, and you were in the midst of the answer.
So one way of countering what some people would think of as this imagery, this, you know, the kind of winged humanoid, often with female characteristics, doesn't really speak to me.
Yeah.
Another way would be analyzing the biblical data about angels, including what they do, what they're capable of, how they're depicted, and looking at the imagery that's associated with them. We mentioned that the eyes they have, the abnormal number of eyes is a symbol of how much they know compared to us. Their wings are a symbol of how they can rapidly get places in a way we can't. The ox and lion imagery is associated with strength and fierceness. And so you can look at all of these things as a kind of way of counterbalancing what you might think of as the more feminized angels from later Western art.
Right.
On the other hand, while people don't have to have a special devotion to angels or their guardian angel, it's always a good thing to say thanks, you know? I mean, your guardian angel's there whether you think about it or not. He has been helping you. And it's a good thing to say thanks. And furthermore, it's a good thing to ask for his help even more. And so I would say, you know, regardless of what images you may have in your mind or what your feelings may be, a good starting point is just saying thanks and can you help me out and things like that. And just being very matter of fact about it and not worrying about what you feel.
Francisco, thanks very, very much for that question. It's internet open forum. All the questions have been submitted via email or various other internet ways. And this one comes from Thomas. Is it within the realm of permissible theological speculation to consider as a real possibility that the fall affects all of time? So the death, not just of humans, but of all living things, both result from the fall and has always existed so far back as we can probe with science.
And there's more to his question.
Oh, I beg your pardon. I recall that your opinion then was to prefer the idea that animal and plant death existed before the fall, but that human death did not because of grace that was lost in the fall. Something about this view bothers me. The preternatural grace of Adam and Eve would, on this view, appear to exceed the grace of Mary, who is thought of as having the fullness of grace in some sense. If one held as a possibility that Mary's grace was so full as possible for a human before death in the physical universe as we know it, then the superior grace of Adam and Eve in that case might have involved a contribution due to the state of the universe itself, which did not naturally tend to corrupt the body toward death.
Okay, so a few things. The first one is don't get too hung up on the phrase full of grace or fullness of grace, because that's not what it literally says in Greek. What kecheratomene, the word that Luke uses in Greek, literally means is lady who has been graced.
Okay.
Full of grace is a kind of poetic gloss.
Yeah.
But sure, there's a sense in which Mary has a special fullness of grace compared to other people. And the question is then, well, in what ways? Well, she got to be the mom of the Messiah.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty big one. To prepare her for that, she was also immaculate, and she got to go to heaven early via her assumption. It may have included other things, like having the gift of impeccability, inability to sin.
Oh.
And that's a matter of theological speculation, not a teaching of the church. But it's a legitimate speculation to say, yeah, she may have received early the same grace that we'll get when we're in heaven of not being able to sin.
Uh-huh.
So she may have been impeccable early as well. Well, guess what? Adam and Eve didn't have that.
No, clearly not.
Yeah.
Or we wouldn't be in this mess we're in.
So there is a sense in which Mary would have more grace than Adam and Eve if she's impeccable.
Right.
Also, she didn't have immortality, and at least if they had stayed in the garden, they would have been immortal.
Right.
But Mary didn't have that, so far as we know. Maybe she did, actually, because it's not for sure she died. Yeah. But it certainly wasn't true of Jesus, because he did die.
Yeah.
And he had more grace, He's even better than the original Adam. Let's put it that way.
He sure is.
So I wouldn't say even if you want to say Mary and Jesus need to be greater than Adam and Eve, that doesn't mean you can draw clear implications about immortality for Mary and Jesus compared to Adam and Eve. Having said that, there is to answer the basic question, can you speculate, because he said, is it within the realm of permissible theological speculation, can you speculate that all of the death in history, including before Adam and Eve, is a result of Adam's fall? So the idea here would be that the fall, I'm going to use a fancy word, but is a trans-historical event. The idea would be in his eternal now, God foresaw that if he creates Adam, Adam will fall.
Yeah.
And he then allows that, he then creates a universe around Adam that has death in it from the beginning.
Yeah.
So that it's a universe that suits the choice that Adam makes, even though Adam doesn't make it for billions of years.
Okay.
Is it permitted to speculate that? Yes. Yeah. There is nothing in church teaching that says that's impossible. So it's permitted speculation. It's not contrary to church teaching. In fact, there have been highly placed theologians who have speculated exactly this. One of them was Hans Urs von Balthasar, who was such a good theologian, he was appointed a cardinal by John Paul II. He wrote about this. Now, I haven't read all of his writings, but I know he talks about this, at least briefly, in a book he wrote called A Theological Anthropology. And if you happen to get that, Thomas, you want to look at pages 90 and 91 of Hans Urs von Balthasar's A Theological Anthropology, where he proposes exactly that the fall was a kind of transhistorical event where God foresaw what Adam would do and then put him in the kind of the universe that that we find ourselves in. Having said that, I think that's an interesting idea to think about. I think it's still simpler to say, well, really all the Bible requires us to say is that human death entered the world, and it always would have been the case that nature included other things that died. That's a view that's advocated, for example, by St. Thomas Aquinas and St. Augustine. But you're permitted to speculate on the other.
Thomas, thank you very much for the question. We're going to take a quick break now. We'll be right back with more Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Go forth and preach the good news. It's not just a suggestion. If you want to take more seriously the command of Jesus to share the gospel with those around you, consider joining St. Paul Street Evangelization. It's a grassroots organization that brings the Catholic faith to the streets in a non-confrontational way. Visit our website, www.streetevangelization.com, to learn more. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. It's time to do our part.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
Isn't it awesome that we today do not recognize his presence in the Eucharist? Is it because we really don't go to him in humbleness of heart and say, Lord, I don't believe, help my unbelief. Lord, I want to see you. I want to recognize you. I cannot live without you. Are we saying that?
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and Jimmy Akin is our guest. And all of our questions have come from the internet today. It's an internet open forum. Jimmy gathers them up for us, and we just work our way through them. And the next one comes from Lawrence. Lawrence says, circumcision was the beginning of salvation for Jews and baptism for Christians, or was it faith? What is the relationship between baptism and faith in the New Testament?
So he mentioned circumcision, and the exact role that circumcision played in salvation is debated. It's not as well worked out as the theology of baptism is. Having said that, there is a clear relationship between baptism and faith, and it's sort of twofold. In the first place, now we'll take the case of an adult initially. In the case of an adult, it is faith in Jesus that leads you to baptism. Because if you believe that you need to do what Jesus wants you to do, well, Jesus says get baptized. And so your faith in Jesus leads you to baptism. Then at baptism, you also have an infusion of the three theological virtues, faith, hope, and charity. If you don't already have them operating in your soul by a special means.
I see.
But for everybody who gets validly baptized, you receive these virtues. And that can mean that the kind of faith you had that led you to baptism is not necessarily the full virtue of faith that you receive upon baptism. So it gives you, if you haven't by a special miracle of God's mercy already received the full virtue of faith, you receive the full virtue at baptism. So there's a sense in which baptism both leads, faith leads you to baptism and flows from baptism. Now let's take the case of a child or another person who is not capable of having personal faith that would lead him to baptism.
Right.
Still, in this case, somebody's personal faith is leading to that baptism, like the faith of the parents or guardians. It leads them to believe in Jesus and say, well, Jesus wants our child or our ward to be baptized, so we're going to have him baptized.
Yeah.
So still, faith is leading towards baptism, and because the child or other person who can't act on his own behalf can't put a barrier in the way, the baptism is going to be valid, and he's going to receive an infusion of the theological virtues, including the full virtue of faith, even if he's not capable of displaying that virtue at this point in his life because he's too young and doesn't have the right neurology to display it, or because there's something problematic with his neurology and he won't be able to do it in this life, faith is still going to be there in his soul.
Okay, so thank you very, very much for that question, Lawrence. Appreciate it. Again, it's internet open forum. All of our questions have come via the internet. The next one comes from Rome, a person named Rome, not the city of Rome.
So I can't say that Rome is asking me for answers to questions now. Except in the personal sense.
You're right, exactly. That would be an exalted position to be in, wouldn't it, if Rome was just asking you questions? Another angel question. Okay, Rome says, why are angels illustrated using human images with wings where the Bible paints these angels having very weird features?
Well, as we mentioned, sometimes the Bible just depicts angels as if they're human beings, typically young men. But in other passages, like in Isaiah and in Ezekiel, we do have much more unusual depictions of angels that are like hybrids of human and animal form. Having said that, the winged human image is not unique to our culture. Actually, there are winged human images in Etruscan art, and in Roman art, and in Persian art, and in ancient Mesopotamian art. In ancient Mesopotamia, for example, some of the Lamassu were depicted as humans with wings. And in Rome, Victory was often depicted as a human, specifically a woman, but as a human with wings. And so the idea of a human with wings as a kind of supernatural figure is out there in world culture. It's not unique to Christian images of angels. In these beings are, you know, they're depicted as human to indicate that they're in some way relatable to us. You know, they have minds and they're not dumber than we are. So. We can relate to them. They're not simply like animals.
Yeah.
But they also have the wings to indicate they're superior to us. They can do things we can't but would like to, like fly.
Yeah.
So they're kind of like humans, but they're personal, but they're also superior to us. And, well, that's what angels are. Angels are personal beings that are superior to us. And so it could make sense in later Christian art to depict angels as humans with wings. And that started to happen by the late 300s. It may have happened earlier than that, but we have surviving images of humans with wings as angels from the late 300s. And then of course, that's in the late classical period, so we have these like Roman images of the winged victories that were part of their culture at the time. And so it would be natural for Christians to borrow artistic images from their culture that then became incorporated into Christian art.
Thanks, Rome. Great question. We've got time for several more, I'm sure, so we'll keep moving. Let's go to Cindy's question. If you need to be in a state of grace to receive communion, but assuming you're in a state of grace is a mortal sin, how can we receive?
Okay, so we do need to be in a state of grace to receive communion. And the Council of Trent in the 1500s does have cautions against presuming that you are in a state of grace. But there's not actually contradiction here. What Trent is responding to are various groups within the Protestant movement of the time, and this is not all Protestants, but within various Protestant groups at the time, they were using language that would suggest things like, you can know for 100% certainty that you are in a state of grace right now with no possibility of self-deception.
Yeah, that's a pretty weighty promise.
Yeah, even if God hasn't told you.
Uh-huh.
And some of them would even go further and say, unless you believe that you are in a state of grace right now with 100% certainty that admits of no doubt at all, you're not even saved. You're damned.
That would give so much anxiety. I would.
Well, yeah. That's the kind of stuff that Trent is counseling against. It's counseling against these extreme understandings of what kind of confidence we can have. It did not have a problem saying you can know you're in a state of grace or you can be certain, because actually the Franciscans were saying that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
And now Thomists weren't a big fan of that language. But when you study the history of Trent and you read its documents, it is very clear they're phrasing themselves in such a way to allow both the Franciscan and the Thomist understanding of assurance.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have great assurance that you're in a state of grace. You just can't have this infallible stuff unless God like miraculously reveals it to you, because we can self-deceive.
Sure.
And so, yes, you do need to be in a state of grace in order to receive communion. And as long as you reasonably believe that you are in a state of grace, then you can go to communion. But what you shouldn't do is presume to know infallibly that you're in a state of grace, much less should you say, unless you're infallibly confident, you aren't saved. That's just dead wrong. You can be in a state of grace even if you're not 100% sure.
All right. Thank you very, very much for that question, Cindy. Next question comes from Rob. What kind of wine would Jesus have turned the water into?
Well, what we're told in the text in John 2 is that he turned it into wine that was identified by the major domo of the wedding banquet as the highest quality wine.
Mm-hmm.
So it was superior in some way to other wine that was present and being manufactured in their day. So it tasted better. Exactly what kind of wine, it becomes more speculative from that point. I would presume that it was red wine, because as far as I'm aware, the grapes that were cultivated at this point in history and in this location tended to be red,
mm-hmm.
and also red would better foreshadow Jesus's death.
Yeah.
So I would guess it's red wine. I would guess that it would be unfortified. Fortified wine is where you add something to the wine to up the alcohol content.
Oh, okay.
And like you add brandy or something or a distilled liquor or extra sugar or something so that it ups the alcohol content. I would guess it was unfortified, which means if it was not diluted, then it would have maybe something like a 13% alcohol content.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, other than just really good, it's hard to say.
Not Chateau Canaan or something like that.
Chateau Canaan.
Chateau Canaan.
Don't think so.
All right, we got time for more. I'm going to keep going. Rob asks this. Could the behemoth or leviathan be a dinosaur instead of just a hippopotamus?
Yeah, so there are these figures that are referred to typically in the poetic books of the Old Testament, like Job, that are referred to as behemoth and leviathan. And it's not entirely clear exactly what they were. That has led some modern translations to say, the behemoth one seems to be a kind of big creature, and the leviathan seems to be one that kind of is connected with water.
Yeah.
So maybe the behemoth is like a hippopotamus and a leviathan is like a crocodile.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had both hippopotami and crocodiles in this part of the world, in Egypt in particular.
Yeah.
And in fact, there's a great, unfortunately, we don't have the whole document, but there is a great document from ancient Egypt that records the beginning of the end of the reign of the Hyksos. The Hyksos were these Semitic rulers who came in and were ruling northern Egypt and the delta, and you had other Egyptian rulers to the south, but they eventually drove out the Hyksos and reclaimed and reunified Egypt under Egyptian rule. And the start of that is depicted in this document we have as one of the kings, one of the Hyksos kings, one of these Semitic guys, these foreigners, sends a message to this little Egyptian king saying, the hippopotami in your pools are roaring too loud and keeping me awake at night, even though they're hundreds of miles distant. And so there's no way this is literally true. This is some kind of provocative insult that leads to warfare. But
you just don't insult a man's hippopotami.
Your hippopotami are too loud. Turn it down. Come on. So these were animals that were kind of big and fearsome and connected with water, and so maybe that's what they were. Problem is, we just don't have good evidence for that. I mean, that's just speculation. It is equally better, I would say it's better to understand these as mythological figures.
Okay.
And it's kind of like saying God conquers Behemoth or Leviathan is kind of like saying God conquers a dragon.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have to, a dragon is this fearsome mythological creature, and even if dragons exist, God would totally kick their butts.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I think that's essentially what's going on in these passages. They're magnifying God by comparing his greatness to these fearsome legendary creatures that that even as amazing as they are, aren't as amazing as God. Now, what would the basis of these legendary creatures be? Could, as Rob suggests, it have been dinosaurs?
I think so.
Yeah, it could.
Yeah.
Because fossils have not just been dug up in the last 200 years. Fossils have, I mean, the thing that we've been looking for them for like, you know, 200 years. But the fossils themselves are largely uncovered by wind and water erosion. And that has been happening all through human history. So all through human history, there's been wind and water erosion that are exposing new fossils, and people have been finding them all the way down through history. And they've seen these bones of these ancient monstrous animals and said, guess what? There must have been ancient monstrous animals here.
Yeah, right.
And so
maybe there's some still around.
Maybe. St. Augustine, for example, found a monstrously huge tooth on the beach.
Oh, he did.
Yeah. And Greeks and Romans would find these things and American Indians. There's a historian named Adrian Mayer who has written about a couple of books about this. One of them is called The First Fossil Hunters. And she talks about how ancient people in the Greco-Roman world did find these fossils, and they would take them to their temples and things like that. And I would say that that the basis for the legends of Behemoth and Leviathan very likely could be dinosaur bones or mammoth bones or whatever, but ancient fossilized bones that had been found, and then knowledge of these ancient monstrous creatures was in ancient Near Eastern culture, including Hebrew culture, and that's where that comes from.
That's a great question. Thanks so much for that one, Rob. Hey, I'm just going to ask you this because you can give me a yes or no answer on this.
Okay.
Matt asked, will you go back and create audio versions of some of your previous books?
If Catholic Answers wants me to, yeah. And in fact, I know there's plans for at least one of those. It may not happen for all of my books because some, like The Fathers Know Best, it's just a collection of quotes.
Yeah.
So it doesn't have a narrative through line. Yeah. But others, yeah. If I'm asked to, I will. Even independent of that, you could always get the Kindle version and have your Kindle read it to you.
Matt, thanks for that question. Thanks for everybody who sends us these questions. I know lots of folks are in contact with Jimmy in his various spots on the internet, social media and whatnot. But you're always welcome. If there's a question that you would like asked on the air, just send it to us at our email address, radio@catholic.com, and we'll do our very best to get it on the air at some time. Radio@catholic.com. That wraps it up for us. Thank you so much for being here with us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.